So today we're looking at Dhammapada verses 294 and 295, which read as follows. Matarang pitarang hantwa rajano dweja katiye rakthang sanucharang hantwa anigho yati brahmano. Matarang pitarang hantwa rajano dweja sotiye vayagha panchamang hantwa anigho yati brahmano. Which mean, having killed mother and father and the two warrior kings, having killed the kingdom together with its government, free from untroubled goes the Holy One. And then the next verse, having killed mother and father, having killed the two philosopher kings, having killed the tiger as the fifth, untroubled goes the Holy One. So these two verses are an example of the Buddha using metaphors, riddles, as a means of teaching to challenge his students. There's not much of a story, but the story relates to a monk named Lakunta Badiya. Lakunta means dwarf, something like dwarf, I guess. He was a very short monk. He looked like a child. He was an elder, he was an arahant, but he was very small in stature. He looked like a kid. And so the young novices would tease him, pulling his ears, poking him, making fun of him, asking him if he was okay being ordained, you know, whether he missed his parents, whether he missed his home, whether he missed playing. You know. And here, this is an elder arahant. They're poking and prodding like this, pulling his ears. But he was remarkable. He was one of the Buddha's great disciples, a great preacher of the Dhamma. And he never got upset. So unrelated to the verses, one great lesson you can get from Lakunta Badiya is that a great person doesn't present themselves as great. They aren't conceited about their greatness. A person who demands respect is just full of conceit. A lesson for us, especially those of us who have ordained and feel puffed up and prideful about our ordination. You can remember monks like Lukundi Badia, who people treated like a little kid and they never got upset. But he was constantly underestimated by others as a result of his short stature, by less enlightened beings. And so the Buddha used him as an example. Here, this is an example of two times, these verses given on two different occasions, where the Buddha used it as a means of challenging his less enlightened followers. So these two verses were spoken in regards to Lakunta Badiya when the Buddha had a group of monks in front of him who he could see needed to be challenged. And so he would point to Lakunta Badiya and say, "You should be like that monk. He killed mother and father, killed two kings, killed an entire kingdom with its retinue. And look at him, he goes untroubled. You have to be that great. So the story challenges the audience, the telling of the verses challenges the audience in two ways. The first is, of course, three ways actually. The first is the shock value of the bad nature of the similes. The ideas presented here are obviously not something that is considered to be wholesome. The objectionable nature of the words the Buddha used. It's objectionable to talk about killing one's parents, killing anyone, no? Of course, if you kill a king, one king, let alone two kings, you're likely to be very much in trouble. Two kings, you're likely to have two armies coming after you. Destroying a kingdom, even if it were possible, doesn't sound like a valuable thing. Obviously, a terrible use of one's spiritual life. So just the metaphor. I mean, I don't think it's likely that his audience didn't appreciate that this was probably some metaphorical teaching, but it's still something that's jarring. The thing about teaching people with conceit and underlying latent tendencies to greed and to anger, to getting upset, you know, or to being attached, is that sometimes you have to shock them out of their confidence, out of their egotism, you know, out of their attachment, out of their sense of security. Often with people who have great learning of the Dhamma, or who have been Buddhist since a young age, in Buddhist cultures often there is a great sort of conceit and self-assurance, thinking you know everything, feeling like you know all of the Buddha Dhamma because you've heard it so much and you've studied it so much, and in fact you know nothing because you've never really put it into practice. So these sorts of riddles, using metaphors in ways that are objectionable on the surface, are in and of themselves of value, and you can understand why the Buddha would have used it by understanding that this was to shock the audience out of their sense of security and their feeling of knowing everything, because here they have the Buddha teaching something that's objectionable, and in one way it confuses them, in another way it probably upsets them, and it helps them to see that they're still subject to being upset in this way. But probably the deeper meaning is that this is something that is going to be hard for them to understand. So the second way it's useful is that it confuses, because these are not easy to understand. We have the help of the commentary to explain them to us. The Buddha, in the verse, doesn't actually explain what he's talking about. He says, this guy has killed mother, killed father. And so the audience, unless they have a deep resonance with the Buddha's teaching, they're not likely to get the true meaning of it. Of course, someone who has practiced and gained deep insight into the teaching can probably guess, could say, well, mother, father, what could that be referring to? Could figure it out. But it's valuable for an audience to show them, an unenlightened audience, to show them the lack of depth of their knowledge. The superficial nature of their knowledge as they realize they don't understand what the Buddha is saying. The third way it helps is, the third way this shocks the audience is because of the target, right? Again, using Lakuntabadhyaya, using someone who doesn't seem very dangerous or very spiritually worthy of veneration because he looks like a kid, helps to knock people's expectations on their, to turn upside down people's ideas of and conceptions of what is good and what is holy and what is unholy. Sometimes you have to teach something that is outside of the ordinary way of teaching the Dhamma. This is an example of the Buddha doing just that. So, but we have the luxury of looking at the commentary to help us determine the meaning behind the verses. But they're not that difficult to understand because they all, of course, relate to the teaching. And it's a valuable set of verses to remind us of the core of what it is that we're practicing, and the framework of what it is that we're practicing. So they've broken into four parts. There are four sets of things that we're supposed to kill. First, we have to kill mother. If we want to be like Lukundabhadya, if we want to be a holy one who goes untroubled, the idea here is that it's necessary to kill these four things. Kill mother, kill father, kill two great kings. In the first verse, they are warrior kings, Kattiya kings. In the second verse, they are philosopher kings. But they actually refer to the same thing, still the same two kings. And the fourth one is different in the two verses. But we'll get to that. I'll explain to the extent that I can what that means. So the first is killing mother. Obviously, you should never ever dream of harming your own mother, because of all the people in the world, they've, generally speaking, in most cases, done the most for you that any human being can. Besides someone who gives you the Dhamma, they have given you such nourishment, they have given you life. Without them, our birth would not be possible, carrying us in their womb. Mother is a symbol of nourishment, so obviously not something that you would want to kill when you're talking about your own mother, but to understand these things, it's useful if we think of them not in terms of ours, like our mother, our father, but if we think of them in terms of suffering. What is the mother of suffering, or what is our mother in this, in terms of causing us to suffer? Because, of course, that's what Buddhist spirituality is all about, right? How do we free ourselves from suffering? How do we find peace, happiness? How do we become independent, break the shackles that keep us tied to this cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death, stress, sorrow, lamentation, despair? Well, the mother is an important part of that, that which nourishes, that which gives birth. And that which gives birth to suffering, of course, is craving. Craving is that which nourishes our indentured servitude to the rounds of samsara. We're caught up in the cycle of birth, old age, sickness, and death. We're caught up in the cycle of bondage through craving. It's our craving that leads us to go into debt. It can be physical debt, monetary debt, to engage in relationships that bring us obligations, to lead us to acquire possessions that need care and maintenance, attendance. This is, of course, a core part of the Buddhist teaching, and this is the core target. This is our main enemy. If we can kill this, destroy the cause of suffering, we'd be free, we'd be independent. We wouldn't depend on anything. Without craving, you don't need for things to be a certain way. This is the basic premise of the Buddhist teaching, that if we stop needing things to be a certain way or not be a certain way, or need for this, need for that, we can live life to its fullest. We can be present. We can be at peace. We can live here, there, or anywhere. Whatever situation we find ourselves, without any expectations or needs for things to be this way or that. So this is the true mother. This is that which gives birth, that which causes us to get again and again stuck and caught up in suffering. And that would be enough, but there are other things in our way. There are those things that obstruct our task of killing this progenitor. The next one, the first in the way is the father. Of course, your father is the second person who, generally speaking, for most people, is of greatest worth of respect from us, and someone who we should treat with utmost respect and appreciation for allowing or providing the opportunity or the situation, the conditions. Of course, this is not always the case, but generally speaking, the father is a symbol, even if it's not the father or our father. The whole idea of a father is conceptually or metaphorically or stereotypically archetype is as the protector and the supporter, that which provides the supporting environment for the mother to give birth. So often our fathers, our biological fathers, are of great benefit and of great support and worthy of great respect and appreciation and gratitude. Obviously someone we would last think it would be worth or valuable or of any benefit to kill, and hence the jarring, objectionable nature of the teaching that can be valuable for helping to cause us to question, to wake us up and force our minds into broadening and changing our perspective on things. But the father here that we're talking about is this based on this concept of support and protection. But here it's that which supports and protects the craving. And that which supports and protects craving and keeps us from destroying it and becoming free from it is conceit. I am asmi mana. I am conceit. The conceit that I am. Because if it's just craving, you can face it honestly and it's quite straightforward. Craving is craving, and yes, I have it. It's a habit. It's a bad habit. But I can work through it. However, when conceit enters into it, first of all, the simple idea that I like something. Well, when I like something, that's immutable. That's not something that is removable because it's me. It's I. I prefer this, I prefer that. That sort of statement is what we mean by asmi mana, conceit, the conceit I am, because it involves the idea of this being me. I am the liking. The liking is me. It's a part of me. It gives us the idea that we can never be free from it. It just prevents us. It blocks us. It gets in our way. It obstructs us. Though we might appreciate that craving is a problem, we still think, well, that's just who I am. There's also the conceit that says, I deserve this, or I don't deserve that. So, in terms of happiness and pleasure, we think, I deserve to be happy. And so this is the sort of thing that supports our engagement in craving. I deserve a break. I deserve a vacation. I deserve this. I deserve that. These kind of ideas, this narrative, again, is based on the idea that I am. It ignores the fact that craving is a dhamma that arises. It's a just simple reality that arises and ceases, and it's self-perpetuating. The more liking arises, the more liking will arise in the future. The more that we feed it, the more we encourage it, the more we nourish it, protect it, support it, encourage it like a father. The healthier the baby will be, but in this case the baby is more suffering. So the father has to go. The third is the two great kings. Two kings, the two philosopher kings, the two warrior kings, the two kings. So kings are the rulers. Kings are those who dictate, those who control, those who narrate, who dictate, tell us what we can do and can't do, who set the tone for the whole country. We don't have kings nowadays in most places, however we have government, we have politicians that set rules and laws. We have leaders. But spiritually speaking, there are two great kings. And the commentary notes that there are other kings as well, but king here refers to views. So we have craving, we have conceit, and the third piece of the puzzle is the views. Because conceit will stop you, will prevent you like a guard, a bodyguard, like a father. But a king will dictate and make it impossible for you to even approach or attempt to have your way. And this is the nature of views. Views are beyond conceit. A view is when you believe this is true, that is true, this is right, this is wrong, and so on. And the two great views that are that absolutely are not the only views, but the two great ones are eternalism and nihilism. Or that's not exactly precise translation, but eternalist view and the cutting off, the view of cutting off. And this refers to at the moment of death. So these are spiritual views. There are two prevalent spiritual views. The first is this being, this soul, this I will continue on after death. And the second view is at the moment of death, I cease to exist. My being ceases to exist. There's a cutting off at the moment of death. And these, again, dictate our spiritual life. So with many religious people who identify themselves as religious individuals, much, even in Buddhist circles, much of their activity is focused on the afterlife. How to attain a good afterlife for me. So it's based on, still on the idea of I and me, but focused on the afterlife, focused on future birth. So there are theistic religions that talk about going to heaven and eternal heaven, and so on and so on. And this is a problem from a Buddhist perspective, because again, it will prevent you completely from ever having any interest in eradicating craving, freeing yourself from desire and craving. Why would I need to? Well, if I have the right sort of attachment to God, attachment to my religious leaders, my religious teachings, when I die, I will go to heaven. There are Buddhist sects that call themselves Buddhist that teach this explicitly. They teach you to have faith in some imaginary Buddha that they've created. And if you have faith in him, you don't need to practice. All you need to do is recite his name and you'll be born. Everything will be good. No need to practice. This is wrong view. It's dangerous wrong view, especially coming from people who purport to be Buddhists. Because without the practice, they will never become free from craving. They will die and they will most likely not go to heaven. But even those that do go to some heavenly place are not likely to engage in the practice from there. They really gain nothing but perpetuation of existence. And on the other side, what we see mostly in secular circles is those who believe that when you die, there's nothing. And again, why should you do anything to better yourself? They might make some sort of hand-wavy statements about how you treat others like you want to be treated, but by and large, people who don't believe in anything when you die, who believe that when you die, there's nothing. In other words, don't believe in the perpetuation and of samsara and the continuation of existence, are by and large unethical and unable to commit themselves to ethical principles, given to anger, given to greed, given to addiction and attachment and conceit and arrogance. And because why bother? I mean, logically it makes sense. If when you die, nothing, do what you want. On a deeper level, it's actually still a horrible concept and a horrible philosophy and a view that doesn't just stop you from bettering yourself, but actively makes life worse, because there's nothing beneficial about greed, anger, or delusion, even in this life. They might bring you pleasure to get what you want, to destroy those who oppose you, be conceited. It might provide some rush, some pleasure, but it makes you absolutely a more and more miserable individual, even in this life. There's no comparison to the bliss and peace that comes from goodness and mindfulness and clarity and wisdom. So these are the two kings that the Buddha taught us that we have to be free from. These views that obstruct us. And as I said, there are other kinds of views. There's views that are related to these, the view that there is no karma, there is no cause and effect. Views that greed is good, anger is good, delusion is good even. Good to be proud of yourself, for example. Our views are what perpetuate our conceit, and which protects and perpetuates our craving. So these three actually make up the base, you could say, of the Buddhist teaching in terms of what we are trying to confront through our practice. These are the three bad things. It's a one way of describing all of the evil that exists: craving, conceit, and views. And it's three levels that we can understand. It's a valuable, simple teaching to remember, to keep in mind. When we apply mindfulness, we're addressing these three issues, problems that exist for us, the framework of suffering and stress. The fourth is a little bit complicated. I'm not entirely sure about the extent of it, but in the first verse it's fairly straightforward. It says the kingdom and that which follows the kingdom, or I guess the government, perhaps. Maybe it's the populace, maybe it's the government. But what it's referring to is the realm in which we find ourselves. So with these three hanging over our head, the mother, the father, the two great kings, and all the views, all the kings, we find ourselves in what we might call a kingdom. And this, the commentary says, refers to the kingdom of experience, the six pairs of experiences: the eye and sight, the ear and sound, the nose and smells, the tongue and tastes, the body and feelings, and the mind and thoughts. These six pairs constitute our kingdom, the kingdom in which we find ourselves, ruled by a government. The Buddha said, kill this as well. An arahant has killed this as well. They have killed the kingdom. Because it's not just a kingdom, it's also a prison. We're imprisoned. And it's dictated, the rules of it are dictated by the government, which the commentary says is our attachments to it, our delight in it, seeking out pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant smells, pleasant tastes, pleasant thoughts, pleasant feelings, pleasant thoughts. Again and then again, constantly searching and seeking and trying to arrange our lives so only the good comes to us. And as we're all should be clearly aware, this isn't the outcome that we experience. We're not constantly and consistently confronted only with pleasant sights and pleasant sounds and smells and tastes. We also have to experience the unpleasant sights and sounds and smells and tastes and so on. We're imprisoned by our partiality, our delight, our seeking out delightful sights and sounds and smells. So there's two things to keep in mind here. First is that this is the reality in which we find ourselves. The only kingdom that we ever have, the only realm in which we ever find ourselves, is this realm of experience. Our kingdom is this kingdom of the six senses. We can never escape seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling and thinking, and we can never escape bad sights, unpleasant sights, unpleasant sounds. We can never completely be free from them as long as we're caught up and buying into this concept of samsara, this realm of experience. But an arahant has destroyed the kingdom. And the sense is in that they have, of course, destroyed craving, and they live as though there was no kingdom, as though there was no country. If you think of all of the ways in which Sri Lanka exists, or China exists, or America exists, or Europe exists, for an arahant, it's as though these entities have just ceased to exist, and all there is the land. This is no longer Sri Lanka. For an arahant, it's as though there is no longer the country and all of its laws and regulations and rules and norms and cultures, and there is only just the land. In the same way, what that means is that for an arahant, there is only seeing, there is only hearing, there is only smelling, but there is no prison. They are not tied to these things. They're not tied to good sights, so that only when there are good sights they are happy. Only when there are good sounds, good smells, good tastes, good feelings, good thoughts are they happy. The arahant's peace and happiness and freedom is independent of their experiences. So they might experience, they will still experience all of the senses, but there's no connection in terms of in terms of their peace and their happiness. They are at peace and they are happy regardless of what they experience because of their independence. They have destroyed the kingdom, destroyed the prison. It's like they've destroyed the government. There's no governing body that governs over the mind of an arahant. No matter what they experience, what they are confronted with, they are at peace. For the second verse, it's a little stranger. I'm not sure of the translation. It's translated usually as tiger. I'm not sure that it even means tiger, but the commentary says it refers to the five hindrances. You have to kill the five hindrances. Kill the tiger means to kill the five hindrances, I guess. But I'm not sure where the tiger comes in or why the Buddha used this word. But I'm not sure it translates as tiger, actually. But the point is important. The important thing is that the commentary, as the commentary points out, the hindrances are the prison. Another way of describing our existence is the existence of those things that keep us tied, that prevent us from finding freedom. So the hindrances, of course, we know as liking, disliking, drowsiness or sloth, worry and distraction, and doubt. And what we mean by the word hindrances is that they are things that, in general, hinder us. They prevent us from finding peace. You want to be happy, they prevent you from being happy. You want to see clearly, they prevent you from seeing clearly. They are those things which keep us tied to samsara, but also the meaning is that they keep us from finding freedom. And so they are like a tiger, I guess. But they are also like the government. They are that which keeps us tied to samsara. And so again, they relate to the situation in which we find ourselves. So because of the existence of craving, because of our conceit, because of our views, we find ourselves in a state that is tied down and hindered and prevented. We are held back from reaching our true potential and from fully understanding and confronting and coming to terms with the nature of reality. So the lesson for us with the story and the verse, I think, simply relates again to these three main concepts of craving, conceit, and views. There are three enemies that we watch out for, that we identify as Buddhists, that and acknowledge this is the main reason for us to come to practice mindfulness. Because through the practice of mindfulness, we confront and free ourselves from these. Obviously, craving is a clear object of attack through the practice of mindfulness, whereby being mindful of our experiences, mindful of the things that we experience and our reactions to them, we come to see that nothing we might cling to is actually worth clinging to. Nothing we would could crave for is actually worth craving. That the process of craving and clinging doesn't lead us to be happier, doesn't lead us to peace, doesn't lead us to freedom from suffering. And conceit being a little more difficult to identify, but worthy of identification and absolutely essential in our practice, that we acknowledge that we're not just dealing with our cravings, we're also dealing with our conceit, our judgments of things as right, as wrong. Yeah. We can't tackle the issue of craving until we acknowledge that we're kind of attached to craving. We think, but it's my craving. I want that. Why should I get rid of it? I want it. Why should I free myself from what I want? That it goes deeper than just craving. We have lots of attachments to self, to ego. We have ego about our craving, basically. And thirdly, of course, our views. We have to appreciate that even if we know Buddhism, we don't really know the truth. And more, even greater when we don't know Buddhism, when we come new to Buddhism, to appreciate that many of the ways in which we look at reality, are based on wrong view, based on false premises. And so we have to, at the very least, abandon our requirement for views, or our reliance on views. We don't have to take up new views. Buddhism isn't about believing anything. But we have to put aside our views and acknowledge that these views are coloring our experience, and try our best to just focus on experience, to take the experiences at face value, to appreciate them for what they are, without bias, without prejudice, so that we can see the nature of things, and so that ultimately we can understand and realize for ourselves that nothing is worth clinging to. There is no thing in us or in the world around us that is worth us holding on to, craving after, seeking out, keeping, or identifying with as me or mine or under my control. So a valuable lesson, a great one to keep in mind, because it's quite simple and memorable. Because we have the metaphors, the symbols to remember the mother, the father, and the two great kings. And to remember that this is a kingdom that we are imprisoned in, subject to its laws, subject to its government. Meaning we are subject to the whims of samsara because of our craving and our expectation and our attachment. So that's the Dhamma for today. Thank you for listening.